Congratulations on your new car company.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. General Motors emerged from bankruptcy this morning, just 40 days after it filed for Chapter 11. The automaker sloughed its debts off to the old General Motors and sold its best brands and assets to the new GM, which is mostly owned by the U.S. government. CEO Fritz Henderson said this morning it's a whole new GM.
The last 100 days has shown everyone, including ourselves, that a company not known for quick action can in fact and indeed move very fast. Starting today, we want to take that intensity, the decisiveness, and the speed of these last several weeks, and then transfer it from the battlefield triage of the bankruptcy process to the day-to-day operation of the new company.
Henderson said the new GM will focus on customer service, launch 10 new cars over the next 18 months, and partner up with eBay to create a new way to bid on and buy cars. Yeah, eBay. Doug Foreman is the director of equities at Highmark Capital in San Francisco. He joins us live. Hi, Doug.
Good morning, Stacey.
Good morning. So GM saying it's back on track, that it's going to repay the $50 billion it owes the government early. Do you think this turnaround effort is going to work?
Well, you know, I think it's clearly a positive that they've been able to get through this bankruptcy process faster than expected. That clearly helps their sales and their reputation in the marketplace. And as you pointed out, they've shed a lot of debt and employees and brands and dealerships. Those are all very positive moves. But I think, you know, the car industry right now is mirrored in an obvious recession that's pretty terrible. We've gone from about 16 to 17 million units a year in sales down to about 10. And I think GM's going to need some wind at its back and, you know, a tide to rise to pull off this turnaround that we're all looking for as taxpayers. So I think, you know, you need to see industry car sales pick back up some to the 12, 13 million range, which we think they will at some point, which is just normal replacement. But I think in the meantime, you know, they're not well enough positioned to take any massive market share or anything else right now anyway. So they need a tide to rise.
So you think it's a little bit touch and go for them, maybe?
Yeah, I think, you know, not unlike the Chrysler bankruptcy of years ago, you know, they had the tailwind of an improving economy. And, you know, we're hopeful that that's what we're going to get. But if we don't, I think it's going to be a tough road for this company to continue to hoe going forward.
How important is it for the economy that GM succeed?
Well, you know, I think if it was 1965, it'd be absolutely critical that General Motors survive and prosper, and obviously a very important component of the Dow, the S&P, employment, et cetera. Today, you know, after the bankruptcy and even before the bankruptcy, General Motors' status in the economy had been fading for a very long time. So, you know, there's still obviously a lot of people that work there and auto parts suppliers that are dependent upon their livelihood for this company and the industry, but it's clearly not anywhere nearly as important as it used to be.
Doug Foreman of Highmark Capital, thank you.
You're welcome, Stacey.
And the U.S. trade deficit for May fell to its lowest level in more than 9 years, but the markets are not that happy about it. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 0.4% this morning, the NASDAQ up 0.25%, the S&P 500 down 0.33%, oil down below $60 a barrel this morning. You're listening to The Morning Report for Friday, July 10th at marketplace.org. GM isn't the only company trying to wrap up a bankruptcy this week. Parts maker Delphi is trying to sell assets, if not the whole company. But who really wants to make auto parts these days? Alisa Roth reports.
Billionaire investor Wilbur Ross is supposedly interested. Ditto for Carl Icahn, and he's actually bid on Delphi before. Chinese firms have already bought some of the company and are said to want more. But hardly anybody's buying cars right now, so hardly anybody's making them. Greg Lemo-Stein tracks parts makers at Standard & Poor's, and he says there are just too many companies out there making parts.
At the level of sales we're seeing, there's a lot of unused capacity in almost every area of the auto supplier space.
But business will get better eventually. Kimberly Rodriguez works in the auto division at Grant Thornton. She says when people do start buying cars again, then manufacturers will need parts.
So investing in auto right now, if you can pick the right player, those make quite compelling investments right now.
And she thinks that any company can make it through the current shakeout will be a survivor. If you're interested, bids are due today, but you'll have to beat the $3.6 billion deal offered by a private equity firm. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The federal government wants to buy you a car, and President Obama just signed a new law setting aside $1 billion to help. But there are a couple of catches. You've got to already have a car and trade it in for something more fuel efficient. With all the bad news from automakers, what does the industry think? Sally Herships reports on Cash for Clunkers.
Brian Benstock runs a Honda dealership in New York. He gives a thumbs down to the government's bailout of GM.
They didn't save a job. They didn't sell a car. They didn't save a dealer. They didn't save GM.
But he gives a thumbs up to the new Cash for Clunkers plan. Hundreds of dealers have closed over the last 18 months. Benstock sees this plan as a kind of stimulus for the entire industry.
Because dealers are spending additional money for advertising. Dealers are getting direct mail campaigns prepared. We're making arrangements with the salvage companies to take these other cars from us.
But not everyone's convinced Cash for Clunkers will be a runaway success. Cliff Banks works for Ward's Dealer Business, a magazine for car dealers.
One of the questions that some experts have and some dealers have is whether the customers driving the clunkers will be able to get financed by the banks.
Like so much of the rest of the economy, whether Cash for Clunkers works will depend on whether lenders can get on board. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
President Obama wraps up meetings in Italy today. Tonight, he and the First Lady fly to Ghana. The overnight stop in the West African nation will be his first presidential visit to sub-Saharan Africa. He could have chosen another African nation, South Africa, the continent's biggest economy, Nigeria, a major supplier of oil to the U.S., or Kenya, his father's birthplace. Gretchen Wilson explains why he chose Ghana and what it's intended to signal about Obama's approach to Africa and the developing world.
Ghana's not an economic powerhouse. GDP of the former British colony barely tops $17 billion. But the White House calls the country one of our most trusted partners in sub-Saharan Africa. That's because of Ghana's sound governance. Ross Herbert is with the South African Institute of International Affairs.
It went through many years of coups and counter-coups and instability, and it seems to have, in recent years, really learned some of those hard lessons about what not to do.
In last year's presidential election, opposition leader John Atta Mills beat incumbent John Kufuor by just a few thousand votes. Kufuor conceded and stepped down. Compared to Ghana's neighbors, this democratic transfer of power stands out.
It's comparatively an island of stability in a sea of instability in West Africa.
That's what President Obama says his visit will underscore. Last week, he spoke to All Africa Media, an online news company.
Countries that are governed well, that are stable, where the leadership recognizes that they are accountable to the people and that institutions are stronger than any one person, have a track record of producing results for the people, and we want to highlight that.
Tomorrow, President Obama will give a major speech on development and democracy in the Ghanaian parliament. He's likely to promote the idea that transparency, strong court systems, and regular elections can lead to economic growth.
You're not going to get investment without good governance.
President Obama's visit will be brief. He'll return to the U.S. tomorrow night. But we'll hear more about U.S. relations with Africa later this summer. In August, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will attend a trade forum in Nairobi, Kenya, and visit several other countries on the continent. I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Today, China is expected to allow Australian diplomats to meet with a manager at mining giant Rio Tinto. It's an Australian company. The manager was detained several days ago and has been accused of stealing state secrets from China. China hasn't revealed its evidence, but some are wondering whether this has anything to do with a deal gone bad between a Chinese company and Rio Tinto. Tamara Keith reports.
First, some really basic facts. Iron ore is a major ingredient in steel. China makes a lot of steel. Rio Tinto is a heavy hitter in the iron ore business. And there's been quite a soap opera brewing between Rio Tinto and Chinalco, a Chinese mining company. The two announced a partnership earlier this year where the state-owned Chinese company would take a significant stake in Rio Tinto. But that didn't go over very well in Australia. Last month, the deal fell through. Dan Eichelson is a trade policy expert at the Cato Institute.
It's what goes on in the business world. So Some people take it personally. Some businesses take it personally. And I know the Chinese have taken this issue as a matter of national pride.
Chinese officials say the dead deal has nothing to do with the detention of the Rio Tinto employees. Right now, there are also heated negotiations to set iron ore prices for the coming year. And Eichelson says detaining employees is probably not the best way to breed goodwill. I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
The Housing and Urban Development Department is sending more than $1 billion to communities across the U.S. to fight homelessness, which has been on the rise. The money will be used for local programs like helping people pay rent and providing housing relief. Jennifer Walsh is a professor of city and regional planning at Berkeley. She joins us to talk about this. Hi, Jennifer.
I'm delighted to be here, Stacey.
Have we ever seen a rise in homelessness like this before?
Well, there have been other recessions. But I think that this recession is deeper than even those prior recessions were. So I'm afraid that we will see more homeless people than we have in the past and a larger upsurge than we have in the past.
We've been hearing a lot about cities and states having budget problems and running out of money. Is that sort of feeding into the potential problem of homelessness as well, as they potentially run out of money for benefits?
I think that the problems that states and localities are facing because of the fiscal crunch is a definite problem with respect to dealing with homelessness. For example, in California, the entire welfare-to-work program in the state is slated for abolition. And that program has provided support and job training to many, many people. And so I think what is likely to happen is there will be real constraints on what states and localities can do as more and more people become homeless.
If states and communities don't get the resources that they need or don't allocate the proper amount of resources to this problem, what could happen?
Well, I think people should expect to see more people in cars, in vans, in campers. They will most likely see signs of homelessness, not just in downtown areas, but also suburban areas where many communities have felt they've been immune to homelessness, but will probably no longer be feeling so immune.
I've read that certain communities are planning on using the stimulus money in kind of innovative ways. Eastern Idaho apparently helping people make rent payments and mortgage payments. Stockton, California, also buying up foreclosed homes to renovate them as affordable housing. How effective do you expect these plans to be?
Well, I think the one silver lining of the downturn in the housing market is that the public sector can purchase housing at lower rates than they were able to do a few years ago. This, in some ways, is an opportunity, but it also relies on the locality or the state having resources and being willing to direct resources to that end.
Jennifer Walsh is the dean of the College of Environmental Design at Berkeley and a professor of city and regional planning. Jennifer, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Some troubling news from TARP watchdogs. The Congressional Oversight Panel reports banks have been making a profit off of the bailout. Here's how it works. In exchange for taxpayer money, banks gave the government warrants, which are kind of like shares. When the banks pay back that bailout money, they buy their warrants back from the government. The oversight panel says Uncle Sam has been letting banks buy those warrants back at a massive discount. Harvard Law School professor Elizabeth Warren heads up the panel.
We think our findings make it clear that Treasury needs to be absolutely transparent about the TARP repayment process, and the banks need to understand there is a public watchdog that's going to be pushing to return the maximum amount to the taxpayer.
The report deals with smaller banks, but Warren told us it's important to set a precedent now, because if the undervaluing continues, taxpayers stand to lose more than $2 billion.
Whatever happens there will determine how much of the upside the American taxpayer gets for the rescue that it gave to financial institutions.
And while we're on the topic of rescue, AIG is in the news again this morning. The troubled insurance giant has gotten about $180 billion in taxpayer money. And this morning, we're hearing they want to give out more performance bonuses. Dan Gretsch has more.
About 40 senior managers at AIG are due bonuses next week worth $2.4 million. These bonuses were promised last year. That was before the March backlash over earlier AIG bonuses. Now the insurance giant is reluctant to pay out without political cover. According to several reports, AIG has asked for the blessing of the Obama administration's new compensation czar, Kenneth Feinberg. Feinberg oversees executive pay in seven bailed-out firms. But he doesn't have any say in this case, since they were promised in the past. Hugh Johnson heads a money management company. He says AIG is obligated to pay.
They promised the bonuses. They should pay them for that reason. They should also pay the bonuses in order to stay competitive in an extraordinarily complex and intensely competitive business.
But that explanation is unlikely to deflect further public outrage. AIG is scheduled to pay the bonuses on Wednesday. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
And finally, you've probably heard that California is now issuing IOUs to pay its bills. The Golden State says they're as good as cash. Not everybody agrees. Take the reaction of this guy from the 1994 film Dumb and Dumber.
Where's all the money?
That's as good as money, sir. Those are IOUs. Go ahead and add it up. Every cent's accounted for. Look, see this? That's a car. $275,000. Might want to hang on to that one.
You're a dead man. You're a dead man!
Okay, so Bank of America and Wells Fargo aren't that upset, but they're among the banks saying they're not going to redeem Cali's IOUs after today. That's bad news for the state, which is running a $26 billion budget deficit. Maybe they'll try rain checks next. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.